And the woman who he has spoken to before at the adoption agency said, well, yes, as a matter of fact, I do have more information. Are you sitting down? And Alexander was driving at the time. And she said, well, you better pull over. And the information she gave him was that indeed his birth mother was 16. And indeed she had given him up at 10th day or 14th day. But then the new information was that she had then married his birth father and had another family. And Alexander, just the bottom fell out for him. Suddenly he felt unwanted, unloved, deeply betrayed, and for the next 5 or 6 years his practice started to go into this sinkhole. His marriage was troubled. He was having a terrible time. And finally, his sister and his wife prevailed upon him to call again. Please call and get more information, because we need... So he did, and this time... Oh, when he called with his son in the car on ski vacation, the adoption agency person said, I'm sorry, your birth mother cannot see you now. I've asked her. She said no, because one of these children in the new family she had has just died, and she's not able to see you. And he felt doubly rejected again. So anyway, after this period of depression and the sister and his wife, he got into therapy, couples therapy. They tried to get him out of his depression. He just couldn't shake it. So he finally met with his birth mother. Now she was willing to see him. And she said, it was terrible. She said, I can't tell you how terrible this was for me. I deliberated and I pained and agonized whether to keep you, how to do it. I had made a contract. I understood that I was supposed to give you up, but I just couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear it. Finally, I prevailed upon myself to say goodbye to you. And we had one last, very tearful goodbye. And she said, and when I gave you up, you went into a week-long, near-death, failure to thrive as an infant. You had to be hooked up to IVs, and you had to be resuscitated, and they saved you. And I felt terrible about it, but that's what happened. Now, for those of you who know the book, he suffered an E. coli infection of his cortex. He went into a coma for 1 week. The E. coli infection of the cortex is almost unheard of in adult patients, but it is well known in infants. And the primary thing that Alexander talked about in his near-death experience was breaking through the light into a beautiful world where he was on the wing of a butterfly, flying over the landscape, and the whole landscape was saturated with love, and he knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was loved. Now, I think that there's a relationship between that week of trauma in infancy, unremembered trauma, where he felt in his bones, in his very cells of his body, unloved, abandoned, dropped. But he couldn't register it psychically or consciously because he was 10 days old. I think there's a relationship between that week and the week of spiritual enlightenment in which he realized that he was loved, don't you? Now, if we link those 2 weeks, then we have a psycho-spiritual understanding. We haven't gone off as proof of heaven. We haven't said this is nothing but an artifact of the early experience. We've said that through the traumatic rupture, you fell into something that was there to catch you. And now you've had an experience of it. See the difference? It's like through the earthquake fault of that early unremembered trauma, he fell into God. He fell into the light. He fell into the mythopoetic psyche, and now he has the story. He now has an image, now he has a story. And he's off on the circuit with Omega Institute and everywhere, talking about proof of heaven. And who is it, the near-death guy, Raymond Moody, is saying that this is the most dramatic and clear proof of the afterlife that we'll ever get. I don't think so. You know, I would prefer to keep it a mystery. I love the mystery that we get when we hold those two worlds together, don't you? So much more interesting than closing down around one world or the other. Yes.
Did you say that when the child, very young, is traumatized, that the soul takes that baby into the subconscious? Is that what I understood you to say?
Well, the only thing we know is that if a child is traumatized, when the trauma starts to heal, we get images of a vulnerable, very precious to the dreamer, part representation, a child, an animal, that comes back in dreams or visions or experiences in the body as having been like a baby in a cage or a child locked up in a cave someplace or something like that, so that we surmise that that part of the psyche that couldn't go on existing in the space between me and you or life, you know, the inner and the outer world, had to go somewhere, so it went into the unconscious, deeply buried there.
If anyone wants to ask a question, please raise your hand, and we'll give you the mic.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're
so courageous.
Oh.
I'm caught up back with the original Lucifer there.
Mm-hmm.
Can we have that slide again, or are they buried?
No, absolutely. Just a minute. I'll go backwards here.
A review.
A retrospective.
Yes.
Not a regression. There he is in his fallen.
There.
Yes.
That's a woman.
Well, you know, what am I going to say?
All right. I've seen a man. You know what? I think that's an anima image. And as I work through Lucifer being an anima mm-hmm. image, it really comes to me that your succeeding slides were full of womb envy, gods wanting to have wombs and vaginas and instead of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel traumatized being trapped in the anima.
That's an interesting comment. You know, this is one of the things about Blake. This is Blake. You know, he doesn't draw the body so that you can really see too clearly. It's sort of a unisexual, display. But your point is well taken. This is certainly has many feminine features. No question. I think we're going to have to limit it to two more, and then we'll pick up, I promise. Hold your questions for tomorrow, because we'll have more conversation. Yes?
Actually, I was going to ask a different question, but I'm going to change it because you're talking about Blake. When I think about Blake, I think about this satanic image as energy, not in the sort of, even protective way that you were speaking mm-hmm. about it. So mm-hmm. how do you take Blake's image of good and evil, you know, and kind of apply it to the principles that you're talking about?
Well, we'll talk more about this tomorrow. Good and evil, remember, are, in Jungian terms, archetypal antinomies. They're totalistic categories, okay? They don't permit shades of gray or anything of that kind. They're extremes. They're the fundaments of the psyche. I like to think about that because Jung has a model of the fundaments of the psyche that I think is very useful, because when we regress, we become fundamentalists. We take up these extremes, these totalistic categories, and so in the same way that a child is subject to archetypal energies and affects that must be humanized. In other words, the child, if you've ever seen a two-year-old in a temper tantrum, the two-year-old is absent. The rage is sweeping through that child. The child is overcome, is possessed by the affect. That's archetypal affect. When that child grows up a little bit and has names for its feelings, you know, Winnicott says the mother introduces and reintroduces the child's body and mind to each other. You're upset. Look what just happened. You're terribly upset. The child slowly, actually Winnicott has a wonderful word for that. He says, as that happens, something comes to indwell in the child. What is that something that indwells? Well, we would say it's the slowly evolving central self, the core self, the soul life, also a healthy ego. But Blake talks about the good and evil extremes, and, you know, life has to take place between heaven and hell, between the extremes, right? That's where the soul is going to gain experience. That's where innocence is going to gain experience. So basically, we're talking about humanization of archaic and typical affects and images. I think that would be consistent with Blake's idea. Okay, one more.
Yes, you spoke to the Proof of Heaven book that Alexandria wrote.
Yes.
And one of the parts of that book that I had difficulty with, because I don't see that side of it, was the mire, the gray, colorless mire that he had to either exit to go to the spiritual world or enter to go back to the living world.
The worm's eye view.
What separated, and I don't.
Yeah.
What's your interpretation?
Well,
he
called it the worm's eye view. Do you remember that?
Yes.
He had this image of being in a dark place where he looked above himself and that looked like roots or arteries or something. He was down in this dark place, and then he felt very trapped and mired down in there, and then he saw this little glimmer of light, and it got bigger and bigger, and then he went through that light into what he calls the core, or the this beautiful, expansive, natural order of meadows and butterflies and happy people down below, and he's riding on the wing of a butterfly with another figure. I didn't know what to make of that. I really didn't. I thought, well, okay, there's the darkness. There's some of the struggle to get out of, you know, a completely one-dimensional embodied existence where you can't see your way through to anything else. It's one world, isn't it? You're stuck there. But it broke open. So I don't know. I think we're all interpreters of that. It was what? A barrier, yeah. Yeah. It was the roots of earth. Yeah, that was consistent with my interpretation too. It was almost like the earthbound images that were part of that then broke through to something that was more spiritual, airy, and up. Flying spirit. Okay, I'm sorry. I think we're out of time. It's now 9:30. Thank you for your patience, and we'll see you tomorrow.